This episode is brought to you by the IoT Impact Conference. Whichever industry you work in, the Internet of Things is a game changer. The only event that gives you access to Internet of Things experts and users in a range of Australian industries is the IoT Impact Conference in Melbourne on June 9. Book your ticket now at www.iothub.com.au/IoT-impact.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the IT News Podcast. On the show this week, we have Sarah Grattan, the Chief Operating Officer at UNICEF Australia. The not-for-profit is using a digital transformation as the catalyst to change the way it raises funds to improve the lives of children. Sarah unpacks this program of work, as well as the organization's IT and digital structure and strategy. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Just to start with, I thought it might be useful just to describe UNICEF to people who may not know or be aware of the extent of UNICEF's operations, both in Australia and globally.
Thanks, Rai. So UNICEF is actually the world's biggest children's charity, working in 190 countries, focused on the survival, protection and development of every child. And what a lot of people don't realise, it is entirely funded through voluntary contributions. And so at UNICEF Australia, our specific purpose is to improve the lives of children, especially the most vulnerable and disadvantaged. So we're really looking at creating a better world for children and young people, no matter what.
Great. And do you want to talk a little bit about your role with the organisation?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the Chief Operating Officer here at UNICEF Australia. So it's almost a bit like a franchise arrangement, I guess. UNICEF Australia is the representative of the UNICEF global body here in the Australian market. And my role is looking after all of operations. So IT, finance, risk, governance, strategy, and all the data and the systems that we have in place here. When you are a charity, and relatively small, we're about 80 people here in Australia, you get to have a breadth of experiences and you have to wear a lot of hats to be able to get things done because we just do not have the budget and the scope to have specialists for all of these roles. So we sort of muck in and do as much as we can.
Fair enough. Now, we're talking specifically today about IT and digital operations. So maybe can you set the scene a little bit and tell us about UNICEF's IT and digital operations, how it's structured, how large it is, for example?
Yeah, sure. So we've actually got a very small team. I have split the technology, security, privacy operations separately to the digital operations. And that second team is a team I call our business solutions team, who are very much responsible for the customer data and the CRM system and the analytics and so forth. And so I've got three people in each team. So very small, lean team. So we're very much about leveraging partners and what we can do to build and run the back of house of the charity operations. And I guess the technology, security, privacy team are very much about cost down and resilience. And my business solutions team is very much focused on capability up. And so they, as I said, very focused on our Salesforce instance, our business rules, the analytics platform, and all of the connections to our service providers and our website. And they're serving up the data to the business for them to use in their operations. And I guess we also have a related team, a third team that sits within our fundraising group, and their focus is the utilization of those insights and the optimization of the data. So they have the real carriage of the website, and the marketing cloud functionality sits with that team. So we all work very closely together across those three teams, particularly on our digital transformation journey that we've been going on. And I guess small team combined with these high aspirations for achieving some best practice in digital marketing can be challenging. And it means we have to be really efficient in the way that we do things.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk a lot about the digital transformation side of things. And I guess to set the scene to that, it seemed like the pandemic has led to a lot of sort of wholesale transformation of charity back-end and front-end systems. And particularly there, I think that's been around the evolution of fundraising models during the pandemic. I wondered if you could talk specifically to your circumstances and the things or the factors that were driving you towards transformation.
Yeah, so we'd actually started the strategy work prior to the pandemic. So I joined UNICEF Australia in 2018, and I was really frustrated that the processes and the data were quite disjointed and inaccessible. And whilst we had this professional team who were working really hard for our supporters, but our systems were 20 years old, and we could see so many opportunities to streamline processes. And at the time, I was running my household from my phone. You can do all your banking, all your shopping, whatever you needed to do, you could do from your phone, but I couldn't run the business from my phone. And it took a really long time from when a supporter gave us a donation for that information to be processed and a thank you and a receipt issued. And so that supporter experience really needed streamlining. But at the time, it was really held up by these aging systems. So I spent about 12 months of strategy development, planning and doing the procurement processes. And we assessed all the different platforms that were available to us at that point. And we decided that a Salesforce instance that was based on the Not-for-Profit Success Pack, which is sort of an accelerator for not-for-profits, would be the best fit for us to radically streamline and automate all of those back-of-house processes and take them from a ping-pong machine of manual data in and outs to something that was streamlined and seamless. We took a detailed discovery project with the chosen not-for-profit specialist vendor so that we could actually achieve a fixed price contract to do the work, because you can probably imagine in a charity and how much money that we needed to invest. We had to be very, very careful as we're stewarding supporter funds and had to make sure every dollar counted. The pandemic actually hit just as we were finalising that discovery work. And so the entire project was done during lockdown in 2020. And it was really urgent because we had all these pinball processes going on, but now they were all having to be achieved remotely by all of the team members being in their own homes. It was really important we could streamline these fundraising processes so we could focus on the emergency at hand and let the team do their work in supporting UNICEF's work for children.
Now, a couple of things to dip into there. That analogy that you mentioned earlier about you could do a lot of things from your phone in terms of managing your household, but you couldn't manage the business. I feel like that's quite a common thread these days in digital transformation, in particular the consumer experience and the things that we're experiencing from a digital perspective, from a consumer standpoint, are really driving a change in the business as well.
Absolutely. And we see the experience that you have when you're liaising with, say, an Amazon to buy something, or even like Uber. You have these really streamlined processes which are immediate, and the consumers don't see the difference with different types of organizations. They go straight to this is seamless, this is easy, this is the user experience that I want. And they expect that in all of their interactions. And the not-for-profit sector have been a bit behind on that because, frankly, the investment hurdle is quite great to be able to jump in and start to change some of the ways of doing things. So you have to be quite visionary and push hard on your board for them to see the importance of that. And luckily our board sort of got right behind it and said, yep, this is worthwhile. And we've certainly seen the benefit now that we've gone through that process.
And the other thing you mentioned there that I thought was interesting was pinball processes. And I wondered if you could just maybe give us a bit of color around what, just an example or two around what the sort of processes are that the organization does in terms of going from the fundraising activity through to the funding activity of the education or immunization or assistance projects.
I mean, mainly in UNICEF Australia, we don't have boots on the ground, so we work through partnerships with other teams and things. But if we go from, say, we've got a communications piece, there's an ad in the paper, there's a digital ad on Facebook, that somebody comes across UNICEF, decides they want to donate or find out more, and they come to our website, interact on the website, and then decide to donate. Press the donate button, and that goes into our website system. What we have to do then to be able to process donations and things is that data has to then get from the website through to the CRM system. And now it's quite seamless, but in our previous iteration, somebody had to download that data. It was once a week. It had to be matched up with what's happening in the bank account. The data has to be uploaded into a system, processed, run a process around receipts for the donation, send out a thank you. That's probably one of the simpler examples. If we've got one of the telemarketing agencies involved and they're taking a call, we're interacting with a number of different parties where this data goes from party to party. And when you have different systems and different sorts of systems, they don't necessarily match up. You don't necessarily have a one ID, if you like, for that supporter across the different systems. And so there's a lot of back-end manipulation and managing to make sure that we've got that integrity. So it used to be very, very manual. But now with our new systems, there's one source of truth and the donor has their ID and all of the transactions related to that donor are together. We can see what's going on. And if they call us, we can see at a glance what's happened, what are the interactions. And it's a much more streamlined supporter experience.
How well were those processes documented? So obviously you've spoken a lot about these different manual steps in terms of batch processing and data matching, for example. How well were they documented so that you could then sort of take that and transform it into Salesforce?
Well, actually, we didn't bring it over. We said, let's start fresh. When you're using a system that's 20 years old, you've got a lot of workaround processes that are put in place. At one stage, we were using Altrix for some data manipulation to try to help streamline some of these processes. So there are a lot of interventions. And part of the benefit of actually having a specialist vendor who had a lot of experience in not-for-profit and doing these sorts of projects with not-for-profits is they'd seen best practice and they brought that with them when we started doing all of that business analysis about what the appropriate data rules and business rules were going to be. So we actually made that decision as an organization. Let's not just try and replicate what we're already doing. If there's a better way of doing things, please let us know and we'll build for the future so that we could really try and leapfrog in our technology.
So when you were putting together that migration plan, how did you go about determining how to approach all the different processes? I assume you work with all the different teams internally that work on those specific areas. And were they giving you instructions or intelligence to then be able to go and streamline some of those processes?
Yeah, so we sort of worked as a joint project team with the vendor, so very closely related to them. There were a few things that I did. So I brought on an experienced CRM manager. So he took the lead on that particular part of the project. I brought in the specialist CRM provider, as I suggested. Then I also had one of our fundraising team members seconded to the project. So she was very detail focused, very strong sort of business analyst, and she became our subject matter expert on our little small team. And then we also brought in a Salesforce developer who had also worked in a not-for-profit. And so they were the core team. And then we had a working group made up of representatives from each of the key parts of the business, all the different types of fundraising. And so they all worked together as we go through user stories for the different cases that we had to consider in what we were building. And we were very much guided by Alphasys in that piece of work and to choose the appropriate things and the appropriate pathways that were going to be right for us. But we didn't want to customize anything overly. We wanted really to leverage that accelerator pack to the extent that we could, because too many integrations can then fail if you've got too many bespoke things. We wanted to be as simple an architecture as possible. We can leave all that development work with Salesforce because they've got the funds to do that continual product development so that we can take the full benefit of whatever they're serving up in this not-for-profit accelerator pack, that we could leverage that. And we just had to put various layers on top, but to keep it as simple as possible.
So in terms of the platform itself that you put in, this new fundraising platform, Salesforce is obviously the major component. Are there other things that plug into that, or is it everything contained within the Salesforce not-for-profit success pack?
No, so we've got a few things. So Salesforce, the backbone, is the not-for-profit success pack. We've got a product called Pronto Payments, which sits on top and runs a lot of the complex donor interactions that we have. So what's interesting about a charity and fundraising is you have a number of very different ways of people giving you money. So it's quite different from maybe retail or what have you, when you go into a shop and you pay money for a good, but we have the products and the different payment types. It really can be quite different. So we might have subscription products where people give every month. We might have the one-off gifts through the website. We might also have some third-party providers who are doing community fundraising where you sponsor a friend, for example. We also have gifts in will. So people often would like to leave a legacy in their will to a charity. So there is multitude of different sorts of interactions and different types of payments. So it can be really quite complex. And so we found Pronto Payments was quite a good add-on for us for that. We also had to link that in with our bank provider payment processes. We've also got a analytics platform that used to be called Einstein Analytics is now Tableau CRM. And we've found that a very powerful way of bringing that data to life and illustrating and visualizing all of those insights. And we're looking at further extending that with a discovery project where it's using AI to start churning through the data and identifying particular trends, who might churn, who might leave, who are the best people to approach, for example, if we're talking about some of our fundraising strategies. And we got Salesforce Marketing Cloud. Now, we had had that previously under our old system, but we had to sort of reinstate it again to link in with this new Salesforce, because both Marketing Cloud and Salesforce wanted to be the boss, if you like, of the two systems. So we had to sort of set them up and integrate them. So again, all that engagement data and information can be all held separately. So they're sort of the key parts of our platform that we've built to engage with our supporters.
Great. And I'm glad you brought up fundraising models there, because I understand that UNICEF Australia is also looking at more always-on kind of models to fundraising, which raises a whole bunch of different challenges, I guess, in terms of how frequently that you approach donors. And I guess maybe the AI that you mentioned may also help with that. But I wondered if you could just talk about this kind of move to an always-on fundraising world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So our individual giving team, as we call them, which is the mass market giving, is actually a digital marketing team. So we're not really doing any other sorts of marketing at the moment. We've gone completely digital. And that's where most of our supporters are. And that's how they want to interact with us. So if we look to the future, that's really about giving them the best digital experience that we can. As I mentioned before, like the old world, the handling of the data was slow and cumbersome. So we were sort of forced into these artificial structures of focusing our communications just four big appeals a year, sort of these big seasonal campaigns. We're really moving away from that now, and we're making the communications trigger much more about a combination of supporter preference, and then we're continually testing and optimizing that for all of the reasons that you say. There's a risk of over communicating, and one of the things I guess our supporters understand that if you have something like an emergency, like the recent Tonga volcano, there are times like that where we truly need their support, and they're really, really supportive at times like that. So ultimately, I guess the always on should always evolve to be the best experience for the supporter. So we need personalized and relevant communications delivered to them at the frequency that they want. So we've got the platform and the tools in place, but it's still going to take us some time through testing to optimize this. We're striving to be more adaptive and to test and learn and make iterative changes. And we can scale up and down these during the year to optimize for our return on investment. So we're doing fewer things, but we're trying to do them better. And then really finding cost efficiencies through the digital communication strategy. And we've partnered with a third-party organization who are taking a lot of our data exports, churning it through some quite complex models that come back with propensity scores that we can then build back into our segmentation databases and things for when we need to do specific asks. And I guess the challenge there is having enough data to really personalize experiences. So it's about how do we go about starting to build that picture up, particularly so we can give the supporters options so they can give in ways that they want to give and how they want to give, and that we can also react swiftly when there's an emergency like we've just seen with Tonga.
Looking at your future plans around leveraging both the Salesforce tech stack, but also the broader tech stack that you've been implementing as part of digital transformation, is there still activity to go in terms of that digital transformation? Is there an end date to it?
Do you know, I don't think these things ever end. So in terms of our broader transformation, we also moved all of our IT systems to the cloud. We're redoing our website at the moment. Our website isn't really being supported for much longer, the technology that's on. So we're going through a website project, and we're also looking at an HRIS at the moment to fill that out. And we also did a new finance system. So I really did a big bang approach with this. You can come at some of these projects and just do it incrementally, but I blew up pretty much every system in the place at once, and we put all new ones in. So it was very high risk. So we had a really strong risk management approach to be able to do that, and it's paid off. So that's great. In terms of going forward, I think what's fantastic about having done this project is the innovation that's been unleashed within members of the team. So in the old world, they'd come to the IT team and say, oh, look, we want to do this thing. And it was always, that's too difficult. But now with this really flexible platform, this is the opportunity that continues to unleash. So they come up with these creative ideas about how to improve the ways that we might be connecting with our supporters, and we can actually move really quickly to enable to get that done. And I guess the analytics platform as well is really revealing to us what works and doesn't work, so we can optimize where we're investing and continually testing variants to make sure where we are putting some marketing dollars, it's where they have their greatest impact, which just gives us much better ROI. I think I just mentioned before about the web presence. So we're updating that with a new website, and then what we're hoping with that, it'll give us opportunities to really personalized content for individuals. So if we have a supporter that's really focused on early childhood education, we can actually provide them with the information, serve that up when they come to our website with key things they're interested in, or maybe they're interested in the climate change initiatives that are happening maybe across Southeast Asia, and we'll be able to deliver them. They can search and find anything they like on the website, but we'll try and make it easy for them to find the information that's most relevant to them. And we also have some non-fundraising parts of the business. So we have an international programs team that monitor projects with funding from DFAT in Southeast Asia and the Pacific, where we focus on these particular projects that we support. And we've also got some Australian programs. This is a sort of a new area that we're involved in, where we're trying to help reduce disadvantage and help vulnerable children here in Australia. And we've got an Indigenous kindergarten project where we're partnering with an organization called IndyKindy, for example. And so we're looking at how can we leverage this new platform now as a part of the central stack to come and look after some other parts of the business and bring that in. So there's some future projects that we've got in the pipeline.
Fantastic. It's an enormous amount of work ahead of you by the sounds of things.
Exactly, especially with this very small team of three. So there's a lot of work. We have to bring in some help where we can, but this team's amazing and they work really hard and really dedicated. And we just have to prioritise the biggest hits first to be able to get through this pipeline of work. But it's been really, really interesting and really rewarding for the team. It's a very exciting spot.
Excellent. And what excites you about the year ahead? This is a question I've asked everyone on the podcast last year, but this year as well. What's really going to get you excited about being part of UNICEF and being part of the operations of UNICEF?
We've just come off UNICEF Australia's record every year. And by that, record revenue, record amount of activity. And it means something really tangible about the positive impact that we can have for children around the world. And more than anything, what we want to be able to do is continue that growth and that impetus and help to see those results going forward. So we've come up this big steep curve and we want to keep that growth going. And so that's really exciting. So one of the particular projects I'm looking at is in innovation and how we bring some of the innovative tools and practices that we've learned from some of these projects and bring that across the business and help generate new ideas about what else UNICEF Australia can be doing for children. And then the other thing, the big project that we're working on really is this new website, and we're really excited about the opportunities that that's going to bring to the mix. So we really want, I think I mentioned before, the new level of personalization for our supporters to really enhance that supporter experience and do things we haven't even dreamed of yet and keep that innovation going.
That was Sarah Grattan from UNICEF Australia, and that's the podcast for this week. We'll be back with an exciting new interview next week. Until then, you can catch all the latest headlines in Australian IT over at itnews.com.au.